Hare Hare Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Alan Larson. The Swamiji seemed to present himself as an Indian scholar who had come for a short time to do translation work. I never thought of him as a missionary, but during the course of the day, there grew in me a warm affection for this man because he was unmistakably a good man who had found his way to a stability and peace that is very rare. The lectures in Pennsylvania gave Prabhupada his first readings of how his message would be received in America. At Commonwealth Pier in Boston, he had stated in his poem, quote, "I am sure that when this transcendental message penetrates their hearts, they will certainly feel gladdened and thus become liberated from all unhappy conditions of life," end quote. Now this principle was actually being tested in the field. Would they be able to understand? Were they interested? Would they surrender? October 15th. Srila Prabhupada received a letter from Sumati Maharaji in Bombay. Pooja Swami. I am in due receipt of your letter dated 24th, Ultimo, and glad to know that you have safely reached the USA after suffering from seasickness. I thank you for your greetings and blessings. I know by now you must have recovered fully from the sickness and must be keeping good health. I was delighted to read that you have started your activities in the States and have already delivered some lectures. I pray to Lord Balakrishna to give you enough strength to enable you to carry the message of Sri Bhagavatam. I feel that you should stay there until you fully recover from your illness and return only after you have completed your mission. Here, everything is normal. With respects, yours sincerely, Sumati Maharaji. Prabhupada regarded that last line of his letter as especially significant. His well-wisher was urging him to stay in America until he had completed his mission. He had told the immigration officials in New York that he would be staying in America for 2 months. Quote, "I have 1 month sponsorship in Butler," he thought, "and then I have no support, so perhaps I can stay another month," end quote. So he had just 2 months. Sumati Maharaji, however, was urging him to stay on. He saw that the prospects for preaching to the Americans were good, but he felt he would need support from India. At any rate, he had spent long enough in Butler, and he now had 1 month left in America. So he decided to go to New York City and try to preach there before his time was up. But first he wanted to visit Philadelphia, where he had arranged a meeting with a Sanskrit professor, Dr. Norman Brown, at the University of Pennsylvania. Mrs. Agarwal was sorry to see him go. Sally, "After a month, I really loved the Swami. I felt protective in a way, and he wanted to go to Philadelphia, but I couldn't imagine. I told him, I could not imagine him going to Philadelphia for 2 days. He was going to speak there and then to New York. But he knew no one in New York. If the thing didn't pan out in Philadelphia, he was going to New York, and then there was no one. I couldn't imagine. It made me sick. I remember the night he was leaving, about 2 in the morning. I remember sitting there as long as he could wait before Gopal took him to Pittsburgh to get on that bus. Gopal got a handful of change, and I remember telling him how to put the money in the slot so that he could take a bath at the bus station, because he was supposed to take a bath a few times a day. And Gopal told him how to do that, and told him about the automats in New York. He told him what he could eat and what he couldn't eat, and he gave him these coins in a sock, and that's all he left us with. As a sannyasi, stick him in socks. Huh? As a sannyasi, Srila Prabhupada was used to picking up and leaving one place for another. As a mendicant preacher, he had no remorse about leaving behind the quiet life of the Butler YMCA. He had no attachment for the domestic habitat, where he could cook and talk with Sally Agarwal about vacuum cleaners, frozen foods, and American ways. But why had he gone to Butler, and why was he going to New York? He saw it as Krishna's grace. As a pure devotee of Krishna, he wanted to be an instrument for distributing Krishna consciousness. His stay in Butler had been helpful. He had gotten first-hand experience in American life, and he gained confidence that his health was strong and his message communicable. He was glad to see that America had the necessary ingredients for his Indian vegetarian diet, and that the people could understand his English. He had learned that casual one-time lectures here and there were of limited value, and that although there would be opposition from the established religions, people individually were very much interested in what he had to say. On November 18th, he left Butler via Philadelphia for New York City. So by being in Butler, then he could understand that the message, you know, was accepted by individuals. He could see that religions would get in the way. They would be very careful about who he'd speak to and all that. You know, which is natural. They're all going to do that. But he could see that individual persons themselves, you know, hearing, thinking about it and all that, then they would be very nicely established. They would be able to take it up. So all this then he learned by being in Butler. So that was by going to Butler that 1 month, and that was a very good introduction. Very good. Chapter 3, Struggling Alone. I used to sit in the back and listen to his meetings silently. He was speaking all impersonal nonsense, and I kept my silence. Then one day he asked if I would like to speak, and I spoke about Krishna consciousness. I challenged that he was speaking manufactured philosophy and all nonsense from Shankaracharya. He tried to back out and said he was not speaking. Shankaracharya was speaking. I said, "You are representing him. That is the same thing." He then said to me, "Swamiji, I like you very much, but you cannot speak here. But although our philosophies differ, and he would not let me speak, he was kind and I was nice to him." Srila Prabhupada in the conversation. Prabhupada knew no one in New York City, but he had a contact, Dr. Ramamurti Mishra. He had written Dr. Mishra from Butler, enclosing the letter of introduction Paramananda Mehra had given him in Bombay. He had also phoned Mr. Mishra, who welcomed Prabhupada to join him in New York. At Port Authority bus terminal, a student of Dr. Mishra's met him as he arrived from Philadelphia and escorted him directly to an Indian festival in the city. There, Prabhupada met Dr. Mishra, as well as Ravi Shankar and his brother, the dancer Uday Shankar. So this is the musician Ravi Shankar. Right? Uday was his older brother, so he was into music and but specialized in dance. And then Ravi Shankar, he took up music specifically, didn't get involved in dancing. Prabhupada then accompanied Dr. Mishra to his apartment at 33 Riverside Drive, beside the Hudson River. The apartment was on the 14th floor and had large windows overlooking the river. Dr. Mishra gave Prabhupada a room to himself. So Riverside Drive is considered, you know, one of the, you know, upper class areas in Manhattan, because it's right on the riverside, like that. I think Veronica lives on Riverside Drive. Mr. Mishra was a dramatic, showy personality, given to flashing glances and making expressive gestures with his hands. He regularly used words like lovely and beautiful, presenting an artfully polished image of what a guru should be. He was what some New Yorkers referred to as, quote, an uptown swami. Before, right, because uptown means he's living on the upper side, where it's, you know, it's more high class up there and everything like that. So then the uptown swami means, you know, kind of more refined, you know, I guess, sophisticated, and in this case, very showy, dramatic and showy. Before coming to America, Dr. Mishra had been a Sanskrit scholar and a guru, as well as a doctor. He had written a number of books, such as The Textbook of Yoga Psychology and Self-Analysis and Self-Knowledge, a work based on the teachings of the monistic philosopher Shankara. After he came to the United States, he continued with his medical profession, but as he began taking disciples, he gradually dropped his practice. Oh, that explains the Riverside Drive place, because he was a doctor. Although a sannyasi, he did not wear the traditional saffron dhoti and kurta, but instead wore tailored Nehru jackets and white slacks. His complexion was dark, whereas Prabhupada's was golden, and he had a thick black beard. At 44, he was young enough to be Prabhupada's son, but Mr. Mishra had been suffering from bad health when Srila Prabhupada came into his life, and Prabhupada's arrival seemed the perfect medicine. Ramamurti Mishra. His Holiness Prabhupada Bhaktivedanta Goswami really knocked me down with love. He was really an incarnation of love. My body had become a skeleton, and he really brought me back to life, his cooking, and especially his love and his devotion to Lord Krishna. I was very lazy in the matter of cooking, but he would get up and have ready. Mr. Mishra appreciated that Prabhupada, cooking with the precision of a chemist, would prepare many dishes, and that he had a gusto for eating. Ramamurti Mishra. Yes, because Prabhupada understood is that if you eat, you get energy, right? And then to be able to eat, you have to have appetite, right? And so that then depended upon like his walking and those kind of things. So then Prabhupada was very enthusiastic to eat, walk, you know, exercise nicely, so then he could eat nicely, so he'd digest, so that he'd have energy. Right, so it goes, most people don't make this connection. Right, like that. Ramamurti Mishra. It was not bread he gave me. He gave me prasadam. This was life, and he saved my life. At that time, I was not sure I would live. But his habit to eat on time, whether I was hungry or not, that I very much liked. He'd get up and say, all right, this is Bhagavat Prasad. And I would say, all right. Joan Suval, an old student of Mr. Mishra's, often saw Srila Prabhupada and her teacher together at the Riverside Drive apartment. Joan Suval. I have a memory of Swamiji as a child, in the sense of his being very innocent, a very simple person, very pure. The impression I have from Mr. Mishra is that he regarded Swamiji as a father figure who was kindly and good. But basically, the words most often used referring to Swamiji were like a child, meaning that he was simple in a classical, beautiful sense. Dr. Misra mentioned to me when I was first introduced to Swamiji that he was a very holy man, very religious, wrapped in God consciousness. Swamiji was very sweet. I myself remember him as a very, very good man, even in the practical details of living in New York, which seemed to involve him very much, because he was a practical man and was looking for the best place to begin his work. I remember very well that he was always careful about washing his clothes out every night. I would come in and find a group of students in the living area of Dr. Mistra's apartment, and in the bathroom would be hung Swamiji's orange robes. Srila Prabhupada would sometimes discuss with Dr. Mistra the aim of his visit to America, expressing his spiritual master's vision of establishing Krishna consciousness in the West. He requested Dr. Mistra to help him, but Dr. Mistra would always refer to his own teaching work, which kept him very busy, and his plans for leaving the country soon. After a few weeks, when it became inconvenient to maintain Prabhupada at the apartment, Dr. Mistra shifted him to his Hatha Yoga studio on the fifth floor of 100 West 72nd Street, near Central Park. The large studio was located in the center of the building and included an office and an adjoining private room where Prabhupada stayed. It had no windows. Philosophically, at complete odds with Prabhupada, Dr. Mistra accepted the absolute truth in the impersonal feature, or Brahman, to be supreme. Prabhupada stressed the supremacy of the personal feature, or Bhagavan, following the Vedic theistic philosophy that the most complete understanding of the absolute truth is personal. What does it mean at complete odds? Each one was more strange than the other, or yes? They don't agree. Yeah, it means opposite ends. One says yes, the other says no, or one says black, the other says white. Yeah? Make sense? Now, I can be pulling like this and all that. Cold. No, not cold. Not cold at all. Something, something. Yes, that's why you have to remember your hat. Because when you leave in the morning, maybe not so cold, but as it goes, it gets more cold. Yes? The Bhagavad Gita says the impersonal Brahman is subordinate to Bhagavan and is an emanation from him, just as the sunshine is an emanation from the sun planet. This conclusion had been taught by the leading traditional acharyas of ancient India, such as Ramanuja and Madhva, and Srila Prabhupada was in disciplic succession from Madhva. Dr. Mistra, on the other hand, followed Shankara, who taught that the impersonal presence of the absolute truth is all in all, and that the personality of Godhead is ultimately an illusion. Whereas Prabhupada's theistic philosophy accepted the individual spirit self, Atma, as an eternal servant of the supreme spiritual being, Bhagavan, Dr. Mistra's view accepted the spiritual self not as an individual. Rather, his idea was that since each person is identical with God, the supreme Brahman, there is no need to worship God outside oneself. As Dr. Mistra would put it, everything is one. Srila Prabhupada challenged, if each of us is actually the supreme, then why is this, quote, supreme, suffering and struggling in the material world? Dr. Mistra would counter that the supreme is only temporarily covered by illusion, and that through hatha yoga and meditation, one would become enlightened, understanding, quote, it is all the supreme. Prabhupada would again challenge, but if the supreme could be covered by illusion, then illusion would be greater than God, greater than the supreme. Right? You understand? Because we're saying, the Mayavadis are saying that all this variety, the individuals, is all an illusion. And that through some kind of uplifting process. He's using Hatha Yoga. Some others will use just philosophy or different kinds of schools of Vedic thought. Then you'll realize that everything is one, and then everything will go back. You'll merge back into the Supreme, and everything will be very nice, right? Unfortunately, only as an individual do you understand whether you're nice or not, right? If you don't exist anymore, how do you know if you're happy? Right? Pretty straightforward, but somehow or another it eludes these guys. So they're saying is that, so the point comes up is that the individual is in illusion, but if he's in illusion, how does that happen if he is, if the Brahman is supreme? Yes?
In the story of Guru Vayur, we see that Shankaracharya had fell down from the sky while traveling with Narada Muni because he rejected worshipping Krishna's deity. So, you know, taking that practical example from Shankaracharya's life, how can they prove that, you know, that
they just somehow or another... See, Shankaracharya basically has bewildered them. And he's presented basically Buddhism, which means that everything's, you know, there is nothing like that. And just used Vedic evidence to support it. Right? The Vedic literature he supports it with, while Buddhism rejects the Vedic literature. So then these persons, they are themselves bewildered, because basically all they did was convert from Buddhism to impersonalism. So they didn't really change their viewpoint. Right? So since they're so fixed in that, then because he talks mostly about that, they don't notice that little bit where he talks something else. You understand? He wrote a book on worship of Radha and Krishna, you know, how they're the supreme and everything like this. They don't understand why. They acknowledge he wrote the book, but they don't understand why at all he would have written it. You know? And in, you know, all the temples you're establishing, you know, worship of Devi or of Shiva like this, but in Guru Vayur, then there the deity worship is established by him, but it's all, you know, the elephant procession, they chant Hare Krishna, and, you know, they sing Gita Govinda to the deity and everything. But it's very far out of the way, so I guess maybe that's how it would work, is that all the other places were impersonal, but that one was. But somehow or another, they, I guess being very determined, they just either avoid it or, you know, they don't worry about it. Because if you can say that the Supreme has become covered by illusion, right? So that means illusion is more powerful than the Supreme, right? And if they're saying everything is one, where would illusion come from in the first place? Right? Because if everything's already, you know, transcendental, where does this illusion come from? Right? So if it just appears on its own, that means there's something outside the Supreme. If it's created by the Supreme, that means the Supreme has variety. You know what I'm saying? So the difficulty is that their philosophy doesn't make sense, but, you know, they're very happy with it. So in the same way as... So also that same kind of principle, that's what Narad Muni was pointing out to Vyasadeva, is that you may talk most of the time about one thing, but then for, you know, just you give a little point about something else, even though you stress that that's more important, people won't notice it. You know what I'm saying? You know, if you speak so many verses about the impersonal, but then a few verses are about the personal, they won't take that into consideration. So in the same way, Vyasadeva in Mahabharata, so much is on the culture and everything else like that, but very little is on actually the essence of God consciousness and appropriate lifestyle, so people won't take that seriously. So that's why then Bhagavatam is written, because then all it's about is about the pastimes of the Lord and the devotees. So then it's you will take it seriously. Is that okay? Yeah? Yes, you understand all this? Right? At some point you should understand all this, because people talk like this, so you should be able to know what to say. Yes? No? What do you think? Yeah? Good? Prabhupada considered Dr. Misra a Mayavadi because of his inadvertent acceptance that Maya, illusion, is greater than the absolute truth. That's why it's Mayavad, because they take Maya has covered the Supreme, and therefore then you have all the manifestations as we see in the individual living entities. That's their idea. So that's why we call them Mayavadis, right? They're in the impersonal school, but they're actually not technically impersonalists. Because an impersonalist, or they're not Brahmavadis, they're impersonalists, so they're not Brahmavadis. Because a Brahmavadi, everything is Brahman, so there is no illusion. Right? It's just, you just have to understand that everything is transcendental. And so then you see it that way. So they don't say worship of the deity, the form is illusion. They just say it's all Brahman. Right? Because Brahman is a state of existence. It's not a matter of forms and this and that. It's a state of existence. It's just like, let us say, you're happy. So you're in this room, you're in that room, you're inside, you're outside, doesn't matter, you're happy. Does that make sense? So it doesn't matter what the environment is, you're always happy. So if you're Brahman realized, you know, and so it's not that you don't notice the rooms, but it doesn't change your attitude, right? So the Brahman realized person, no matter where they are, they can distinguish the variety, but it's all considered as transcendence. Does that make sense? Like that. Yes? Yes.
What do the Mayavadis call themselves?
I think they might even call them Mayavadis. Yeah, a lot of times these names are just like Sahajiyas. That's actually what they call themselves. They're actually called Sahajiya. So, you know, the Smartas, they're Smartas. That's what they're known as. Like that. You know, like when I say in London, around Soho Park. You know, you have punks sitting around on the benches and that, but they call themselves punks. Like that, you know, it's just the way it is. Yeah, in other words, they'll call it some Shankarites. You know, they follow Shankaracharya. Prabhupada considered Dr. Misra a Mayavadi because of his inadvertent acceptance that Maya, illusion, is greater than the absolute truth. He said inadvertent because they don't actually say, because they can't say it's superior because Brahman is superior. But unless it's superior, how does it control? And then if you say, well, no, because the Supreme, it's his pastime. But the thing is, his pastime then indicates, you know, interaction, relationship, the choice. And but at the same time as they say everything's all one. You know, so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, it's just something to keep the material intelligence busy. And because people are more interested in mundane rather than spiritual, then they accept these philosophies. You know, if they're actually interested in spiritual, you know, rather than mundane intelligence or emotion, then they would be able to see beyond this. Yeah? Yes.
Do the Brahmavadis consider Maya also as Brahman?
Maya as Brahman, no. Somehow or another, Maya is something separate. Because it's an illusion. So basically they say it's an illusion that it exists. But the thing is that it has that power means there must be something existing there.
Yeah. That's something the Brahmavadis missed out.
They're not technically Brahmavadis. They claim that they're in that school, but they're technically not. Technically, they're Buddhists. Buddhism is your, if you're not connecting something to the Lord, you know, in the how you say, connected with the impersonal, you know, the Brahman platform where you accept the Brahman as supreme. But you're not, means if you're not accepting Vedic literature and you're not accepting the Brahman as, you know, the, just everything's Brahman, so that there's variety, but variety is also part of Brahman. So whatever there is Brahman. If you're not accepting in that kind of way, then everything else technically is Buddhism, is voidism, because it all disappears. It all, it's not supposed to be here. It's just, it goes away. You know, if you understand, it's like a dream. You know, it's not actually there. You just think it's there. You know, that's their idea. But the dream is a dream. It is a state of existence. You are in a dreaming state. So it's not that it's an illusion. It means it's not reality, but it's not that it's an illusion. If you think this is the reality, that's illusion. But it does exist. So that's the difference. You know, we'll say is, okay, it's not transcendental, but it exists. Right? Does that make sense? So, but the Mayavadis will say it doesn't exist. It's not there. The pillar is not there. Your individual character is not there. We say it's there, just unless it's connected to the Lord, then it's just mundane. Right? Does that make sense? So the illusion is not understanding its connection with the Supreme Lord. And that's the... For Srila Prabhupada, not only was the impersonal philosophy unpalatable, it was an insult to the personality of Godhead. According to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, 7.24 and 9.11, quote, unintelligent men who know me not think I have assumed this form and personality. Due to their small knowledge, they do not know my higher nature, which is changeless and supreme. Fools deride me when I appear in this human form. They do not know my transcendental nature and my supreme dominion over all that be. Right? So that the foolish persons, even though they may claim to be intelligent or very, you know, technically they know how to use their brain, they're unintelligent because they can't come up with the right answer. Right? You understand? Let's say someone can do very advanced mathematical calculations, but at the end of the day, after that huge calculation, their end calculation is wrong. How can we say they're intelligent, even though they can manipulate the numbers and use all these formulas? Right? You can't really say they're intelligent. Right? Because they come up, and the worst part is they think their wrong answer is right. Right? Does that make sense? Lord Chaitanya had also strongly refuted the Mayavad philosophy. Quote, everything about the Supreme Personality of Godhead is spiritual, including his body, opulence, and paraphernalia. Mayavad philosophy, however, covers his spiritual opulence and advocates the theory of impersonalism. Because right? You're working on it that the material is giving us problems, so you want to get out of that problem. So that means then all the things that cause problem. What causes problem? Right? Individual living entities, various forms that are there, attachment to those forms, interacting with those forms. Right? That causes all the problem. So the Mayavadi's idea is if I want to get rid of this problem, then that means I have to do the opposite of this. So because material form is a problem, right? Material individuality is a problem. So if we get rid of that and say that spiritual means there is no individuality, there is no forms and all that, then it seems to be very clear, right? Does that make sense? So, but what they miss is that there is spiritual form, right? The problem is material form, material individuality, right? Where you identify with the mundane, but when the individual identifies on the spiritual platform, right? The individual identifies in that way, then it becomes very nice. Does that make sense? So that's the problem. is that they have this mistaken idea that spiritual has to be the opposite of material. And so therefore, since this has variety and forms and individuality, so that means spiritual can't have any variety, no forms or individuality. Right? That's their logic. But they don't understand as if it's a reflection, right? Means that the reflection in the mirror, that's actually not real. Means it's real as a reflection, but it's not actually the form. It's a reflection of the form. It exists, but it's not. So the real form is the person standing in front of the mirror, right? So they don't catch it that being a reflection, therefore there is the forms here are reflections of the forms there, right? Just that there it's real, just like the tree on the bank. The tree on the bank of the river, it has all forms, the bark is there, it has fragrance, you have fruit, flowers, all that is there, right? You can do so many things with it. But it's reflected in the water. And in the water, it looks exactly the same. The only difference is that it doesn't actually, you don't get anything from its fruits and flowers and bark and everything. You can't get anything from it. Right? So you can put things together, but it's not actually getting it. You get an experience, but you don't actually get anything. You know what I'm saying? That makes sense? You know, you go out in the back, the little kids go out in the backyard, pick some leaves and this and that and some rocks and sticks, and then, you know, they cook a whole meal and everything, and they sit down and eat it. And so the experience is there, but do they actually get any benefit from it? You know what I'm saying? As far as food, no. It's good fun, but that's about it. So material existence means that they get an experience by being here, but because you're not dealing with real things, right? The real is in the spiritual. This is only a reflection of the real. Therefore, there's no satisfaction for the soul. Right? Right? So that's the thing. They say it's not a reflection, it's just, it doesn't exist at all. You know, it's just like, you see a rope, and you think it's a snake. So they'll say, just like that, there is no material world. You think it's a snake, but it's not. But what they're missing, the point is, the rope is there. You know, there is a rope, but you're mistaking it as a snake. So the material world is there. You would mistake it as a nice place where you can be happy and everything like that. That's not correct. Right? Means it's there, but because you think it's a snake and it's actually a rope, what are you going to get from it? You know what I'm saying? So in the same way, you think the material world is something you can get something from, but you can't because it's not what you think it is. That's Maya, that which is not. Right? You think it's this, but it's not. So you think, I'll be happy with this, but you can't be happy with this because it's not what you think it is. You right? Does that make sense? Just donning the appropriate outfit for the discussion. No, he's saying it's okay. Because Madhva also dresses like that, so... You just have to decide whether it's the Shankara side or the Madhva side. Go ahead. Joy. Before coming to America, Srila Prabhupada had written in his Bhagavatam purports, quote, "The ambitious Mayavadi philosophers desire to merge into the existence of the Lord. This form of mukti, liberation, means denying one's individual existence. In other words, it is a kind of spiritual suicide. It is absolutely opposed to the philosophy of bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga offers immortality to the individual conditioned soul. If one follows the Mayavad philosophy, he misses his opportunity to become immortal after giving up the material body." End quote. In the words of Lord Chaitanya, Mayavadi Krishna Aparadhi. So, Mayavadi impersonalists are great offenders unto Lord Krishna. Thus, Lord Chaitanya had concluded that if one even hears the commentary of Shankaracharya, one's entire spiritual life is spoiled. Dr. Misra was content to align himself with the philosophy of Shankara and allow Prabhupada to stay with Lord Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita. But Srila Prabhupada pointed out that even Shankara accepted that the personality of Godhead, Krishna or Narayan, exists eternally beyond the material world. Therefore, he is transcendental person. Narayanaf paro vyaktat. Yeah. So their idea of immortality means that they don't exist as an individual. While the devotional philosophy is that one exists eternally as an individual. Right? A mendicant, Srila Prabhupada was temporarily dependent on the goodwill of his Mayavadi acquaintance, with whom he regularly ate and conversed and from whom he accepted shelter. But what a great inconvenience it was. He had come to America to speak purely and boldly about Krishna, but he was being restricted. In Butler, he had been confined by his hosts, middle-class sensibilities. Now he was silenced in a different way. He was treated with kindness, but he was considered a threat. Dr. Misra could not allow his students to hear the exclusive praise of Lord Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right, so when he's a butler, he's staying, you know, with his hosts there. But then they're always worried about, you know, how it will be seen socially, right? Middle class sensibilities. And then here is that he was a threat because he was speaking personalism, while his host is impersonal, right? So one always has to be careful of these things. So Prabhupada, you know. They means you may deal with them, but they shouldn't get in the way. Right? They shouldn't get in the way. Spending most of his time in his new room, Srila Prabhupada kept at his typing and translating. But when Dr. Misra held his yoga classes, Prabhupada would sometimes come out and lead a kirtan or lecture. Robert Nelson, one of Prabhupada's first young sympathizers in New York. Oh, Robert Nelson. Oh, this is, he's speaking. I went to Dr. Misra's service, and Dr. Misra talked. Swamiji was sitting on a bench, and then all of a sudden, Dr. Misra stops the service, and he gets a big smile and says, Swamiji will sing us a song. I think Dr. Misra wouldn't let him speak. Somebody told me Dr. Misra didn't want him to speak. Robert Nelson, one of his first, we'll probably see him later. Every morning, hours before, Prabhupada will sing us a song, right? And they'll do kirtan. Right? Big smile. Swamiji will sing us a song. Yes. Every morning, several hours before dawn, Prabhupada would rise, take his bath, chant Hare Krishna on his beads, and work at his translating. While outside his closed-in windowless chamber, dawn came and the city awoke. He had no stove. So daily he had to walk the 7 blocks to the Riverside Drive apartment to cook. It would be late morning when he would come out onto the busy street. He would, so 7 blocks, also the Y was 7 blocks from where he was staying in Butler. You understand what a block is? No? Never heard of Lego bricks? Okay, so the 7 Lego bricks, you put them together, that's 7 blocks. But then same time as that's a brick, so you'd probably have to put some bricks together to make a block. Right? Block is just kind of a like a square thingy. Right? And so 7 of those. Does that make sense? Doesn't make sense. You don't understand a block? You don't have to know how to take the Lego bricks and make a block. That doesn't understand. You understand. So how does he walk 7 blocks? I'm not sure. Maybe he goes around 7 of those little Lego bricks. You don't think so. You have to live in the block. You'd have to be pretty small to live in a brick block.
From my understanding, I understand that
blocks
are some kinds of buildings put together.
Buildings put together. So you're in, so instead of using Lego bricks, you're using buildings now.
I see.
People live in them. Oh, yes, you do have that, an apartment block. That's an apartment block, because you have so many apartments and you stick them all together and then you have a block. So that means then the guy who's in charge of that block, he's the block head. Right? Right, the head block, the block head. Right, makes sense. Any other opinions on this matter? You had an opinion? Huh? No. No one else? A block? Okay, so the city is divided up by all the streets, and you have streets going one way and streets going the other way, right? At 90 degrees, so that makes like squares. So one of those squares is a block. And then on that block, then you have so many, you know, what buildings, whatever it is, residential buildings or office buildings or a mix or anything like that. So that's a block. So then, depending upon where it is, I don't know, the blocks are fairly standard, but they can be a little different some places. But generally, they're about the same. So it would mean like, from here to the temple would be like, what, about three blocks or something? Yeah? Three, maybe four blocks. So it'd be like walking from here to the temple and back. That would be seven blocks, like that. Yes? Sure? Does that work? It would be late morning when he would come out onto the busy street. He would walk north on Columbus Avenue amid the steady flow of pedestrians, pausing at each intersection in the sweeping breeze from the river. What's an intersection?
Where the two roads meet?
Yes, where two streets meet, that's an intersection, right? Because that's the place where they have all the lights and the place where you walk across and, you know, like that. When the light goes green, you go across. When the light goes red, you don't go across. Like that. That kind of stuff. Right? Yeah? Instead of the small town scenery of Butler, he passed through the rows of 30-story office buildings on Columbus Avenue. At street level were shoe repair shops, candy stores, laundries, and continental restaurants. What is continental restaurant?
Restaurant meals from different continents.
Meals from different continents. That's interesting. But that would be intercontinental. Kind of. See, generally when they think of the continent, that means Europe. Right? So the continent is Europe. So continental means European-style cooking. Right? You know, and basically because people from the continent came to America, so it's quite similar. Maybe not necessarily as refined or stuff, but you know, it would be mean, you know, Western style. You know, it's, in other words, it's not Lebanese or Thai or, you know, Namibian or something. You know. Okay? The upper stories held the professional suites of doctors, dentists, and lawyers. Why suites? Doctors like sweets. Dentists like sweets, especially, because kids eat them, they get cavities, and then they get business, so they really like sweets, right? Lawyers, they like to present themselves as sweet, though they're not necessarily. Doctors also try to present themselves as nice and sweet, so that's why they live in suites. Yes?
Suite means like a really fancy hotel room?
Hotel room or apartment, it just they're bigger than normal. They generally have more happening in them. You know, there's more rooms and more, you know, it's more like a house, but it's an apartment, but it's more like a house. It's got the facilities bigger. At the 75th Street, he would turn west and walk through a neighborhood of brownstone apartments and then across Amsterdam to Broadway with its center island park. The greenery there could more accurately be described as blackery, since it was covered with soot and city grime. What's soot?
It's a black stuff that comes with the smoke.
Yeah, the black stuff that comes with the smoke. You know, it's like that there, that's soot from the yajna. And then there's always some idiot who has to, you know, make marks in it because they can. You know, that's the point. It's like there was the, you know, guy was asked why he was doing something was so crazy, and his answer was because it can be done. So in the same way, is that because you can make marks on the ceiling, therefore they do it. Yes? No? You're missing out, right? You thought, wow, I did get to do that. Okay, so we'll stop here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai.